The retirement and IRA show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier and Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, hello and welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition. It's the final Q&A show of May 2025. This is going to be released to the public on the last day of May. I'm only mentioning that because the day after May is the 1st of June, the day after May 31st, and that will be the beginning of National Annuity Awareness Month. So if you've got questions for future Q&A shows that are annuity related, this is a prime opportunity for you to send those in, and we'll do our best to get those questions answered for you during the month of June, where we focus not entirely, but primarily on annuity related questions on the Q&A show. And we'll have some annuity related EDU shows for the month of June as well. So I wanted to mention that right off the bat. If you want to send in your own questions, send them to Jim directly, jim@jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Put in the subject line, question for the podcast, and maybe in all caps, annuity, to really catch his eye and know that you've got a question that might be appropriate for National Annuity Awareness Month. Rainy day today, and hopefully we don't... I saw some lightning earlier, so I got a little nervous. We'd have electrical issues while we were recording, but it's gotten cleared up a little bit, so I think we're through the woods on that. Not that it would probably be noticed by our listeners, as I will have fixed any lightning strike sound effects.
Because it's bone dry here. It's raining where you are?
Oh, yeah. It's been raining, and we had some lightning a little bit ago. The clouds are starting to break now, so the rain has stopped, and I haven't seen lightning for about 20 minutes. But yes, we got a nice hour worth of drizzly rain up here and some lightning.
See, folks, that's the thing that bugs me with Colorado. It's very spotty. Mm-hmm. And I live in Berthoud, and there's a thing called, I call it, the Berthoud bubble. And it's because everybody thinks it's Long's Peak, because if you look out my kitchen window, you see Long's Peak. Berthoud just kind of fronts Long's Peak. It's still many, many miles away, but it just, it's right there in the town. And it's not. There's another reason some meteorology professor from either CU or CSU explained in the local Berthoud paper years ago why many, many storms never reach Berthoud. And it has something to do with the lay of the land. So as someone who loves to garden it, ticks me off even more when I hear Chris saying it's raining. You're only, what, maybe 20-minute drive from my house?
Maybe if as the crow flies. With traffic, it's a little worse than that.
Yeah, not with traffic, but yeah. You're not that far from my house, and it hasn't rained all day at my house. But anyways, I digress. Keep going.
Oh, that's pretty much all I had. Nice.
So you had? Excellent.
I didn't realize it wasn't raining where you were, so I wasn't attempting to brag or anything like that. But
to rub it in, you weren't attempting to rub it in?
No, I wasn't trying to. I assumed it was raining down where you were, too, because it looked like it was cloudy all up and down the Front Range, but clearly not. So I hope
anyways.
Hope you get a little bit later today.
This is the general Q&A show because this will technically play on May 31st. And beginning in June, we will dedicate the four weekly Q&A shows to annuity questions. I have a boatload of annuity questions, but I don't know if there's enough to answer or fill. How many shows are there going to be in June? Is it four or five?
Let's see. Let me look here. We'll have... Oops.
Five.
Clicked the wrong button.
Oh, that's May. I'm looking at May.
So we will have four. There's only four Saturdays four. In June this year.
So we might have room for a couple more annuity questions if anybody has some. Mm-hmm. But I would like to dedicate, and we're still going to do Social Security questions because Social Security is a form of an annuity. Annuity is just mm-hmm. a lifetime stream of guaranteed payments. Social Security is a lifetime stream of guaranteed payments. So good Chris point. Will continue to do his Social Security questions. All righty. Anyways, we should get into the meat and potatoes. We are going to answer a series of questions, general questions. We like to jump into the Social Security question first for Chris. And of course, being the Q&A show, we're going to do the little test with ChatGPT, see how Chris can do with that. I think the score is tied, ChatGPT 3, Chris 3. For those who don't know, we've been, gosh, for well over a year now, I think, listeners have been playing along by sending a little hint for Chris. And then Chris would try to guess the state that the listener is from. I'd say you probably nail about 30% of them. What do you think?
30%? No, I think it feels like more than half, doesn't it?
Yeah, more than half. All right, well, we'll soon find out since we're now keeping official score.
Okay.
And I don't know why. I just started letting Chris play against ChatGPT, to which Chris pointed out, I don't allow Chris to Google, but ChatGPT would go onto the internet to get the answers. So we asked ChatGPT not to search the internet, just go from memory. And I kept busting the little program, always going on the internet. And it admitted, every time it did it, it apologized, but it was cheating. So the new thing is ChatGPT is going to try to guess, based on the question, if it feels Chris is smart enough to answer it correctly or not. So that's kind of what we do. All right. So anyways, let's get into our first Social Security. Unless you have anything else. I don't think you have anything else to say, do you?
I don't think so.
All right. So we'll get to the first Social Security question. Hi, Chris and Jim. I always address Alpha. Prior company rule. Hi, Chris and Jim. I always address Alpha.
Well, alphabetically.
Is he saying that you're the alpha male?
Well, that's clear.
Of this relationship?
That should be assumed. But C comes before
why
J.
Why are you alpha? Who died and left you in charge?
Did you just not hear that on the last show you went on and on about how you love salad? There's your answer right there.
Because I like a salad. I'm not the alpha male.
Well, that's one indicator.
You don't know.
I mean, I like an occasional salad too, but I don't go on and on about how much I love salad. That's a little different.
Maybe that's why I can't get a date. Remember the Seinfeld episode where he ordered salad and the woman he was with ordered steak and then she cooked mutton for him and he didn't like mutton. So he hid the mutton in his pockets and then some dog chased him. Remember that Seinfeld episode? Yeah. But it was all about him ordering a salad on a date and everybody making fun of him. So maybe that's why I'm single. Maybe because I order salads. Women are not impressed with my macho-ness.
Maybe.
But anyways, for some reason, they think you are the alpha male.
No, so. I think it's alphabetical. That's I always address it that way, too. When I'm addressing an email to multiple people, I always go alphabetical order.
Oh, so he's talking alphabetical, even though he wrote alpha.
I'm guessing that's alpha. What it is. But alpha would be appropriate as well.
The macho alpha?
Yeah.
Okay. There is no state question here. I don't think there is. So we can't play against ChatGPT here. But he just jumps right into it. And anybody who doesn't want to play along, because we did receive a Bastygram email over the weekend, someone doesn't like this. If you don't like it, just don't give me a question. You'll still get your question asked like this listener. Mm-hmm. But if you don't want to hear estate question, just don't put one in your email. Okay. I am over my full retirement age and received my first Social Security payment in October 2024. In January of 2025, I received a check with the COLA increase, but no increase for January through September of 2024 for my delayed retirement credits. So I called Social Security in January and was told the payment center is a little bit behind, but I would receive the corrected amount and back payment for January and February. No, for January in February. Surprise, I did not receive it. So I called Social Security again. I was told I needed to wait another month. And now still no update. So I called again in April. This time to my local Social Security office. I was told that the update must be completed manually, and he, so I guess there's only one dude who does this, and he is, quote, too busy. I don't quite know what he means by that. And I have to set up a call with the office technical specialist, and my earliest appointment for that is 6 weeks. I just completed that scheduled call, and now I received a new story. I was told don't expect to receive delayed retirement credits until the end of 2025 or early 2026, since that is how the system works. All right, I don't want to keep reading all this. So I have an observation and question. If this is true, are people who don't call and raise the issue ever going to see their delayed retirement credits that they are owed? Is what I'm being told this time truly accurate? My own research on the web and using artificial intelligence shows that delayed retirement credits should have been calculated at the end of 2024 and added to my Social Security payments in January of 2025. Mm-hmm. Thanks for any insight you can share. If my experience is close to typical for your audience, they could benefit from a PSA on this topic. I was surprised, Chris, because I thought the same thing, that for 2024, they were going to do it in 25 and at the beginning of 25, not the end.
Yeah.
What say you?
That's how it's always worked and how it should work. So for people confused about what's going on here, essentially, once you reach your full retirement age, most people listening to this at this point in time who haven't claimed yet are full retirement age of 67 or just a little shy of 67, somewhere between 66 and 67. But after you reach your full retirement age and you have not yet claimed, you're going to start to earn delayed retirement credits. And they award those on a monthly basis, but there's a little glitch in how they actually grant them to you. They actually evaluate the delayed retirement credits you've earned one time per year. Essentially, at the end of every year, they determine how many delayed retirement credits did you amass that previous year, and then they start to give you those in the following year if you claim that year. If you don't claim, then they'll just accrue even more. And so for him, his story was he earned delayed retirement credits between January and October of 2024. When he claimed in October, he did not receive those delayed retirement credits, and that's normal. That is how the system works. He would not get credit for the January through October 2024 credits until January of 2025 when they do the annual assessment. So he was expecting, as he rightfully should have, that he would start to receive in his January check, which comes in February, the delayed retirement credits that he accrued from January to October of the year prior of 2024. He didn't get them. He started calling to find out why. The initial story, I think, is the correct story. They're just behind, and a lot of systems are being disrupted, and they just are slow on some of these things. And it is a, all these are run in kind of a batch mode at, in the computer system at Social Security. So even though the computer calculates it, there's still some human intervention on running the batches. And, it shouldn't have taken that long before he saw them. The last comment from the so-called technical specialist, where he had to schedule an appointment and talk to him, telling him that he should just wait to the end of 2025 or 2026, not seeing benefit of them for a full year after he should, that's malarkey. That's not how it should work. I'm not saying it's not how it's going to work, because as this year has progressed and Social Security is, the employees there have come under greater attack and having to deal with all sorts of disruptions, then I think things have even slowed down more than they were doing before. And they were already unacceptably slow and clunky, and the problem has just gotten worse. So it should not work the way he was told at the end. It should have worked the way he expected and the way his research and AI told him it should have happened, that all of his delayed retirement credits that he earned between January and October of 2024 should have started to show up in his check in January of 2025, which of course is paid in February of 2025. I could understand a month or two delay from that, but why it's taken this long, and maybe he can follow up and let me know if it's happened. Although I think this email you said came in very recently. So, I would love for this particular listener to ultimately tell us when he sees them. That would be good information for me to pass on to everybody else. But it should not be working the way it's working right now. That is not how it's ever happened. Now, just so you know, if you wait and claim at age 70, no matter when during the year you turn 70, if you claim at 70, they actually manually calculate when you make the claim, the delayed retirement credits all the way through the month of your birth of age 70, and give you the delayed retirement credits immediately. There isn't this annual calculation event that happens to everybody else between full retirement age and age 70. Why they can't figure out a way, and they should, to be, you know, my opinion, they should revise the system so that when you claim, say in October of 2024, from that first payment, you get the delayed retirement credits that you've accrued to that point. So make it real-time calculation. That technology exists. That needs to be deployed at Social Security. But until that time, it's going to work the way it always has, which is not the defective way that's being described here from that technical specialist. That is, I don't know, a result of the current disruption. I don't know, but I'd love to hear back from this person when they actually start to receive them so we can pass that on to everybody else. So I will do that if I hear.
Okay. That was a confusing answer for something, I will say that, which brings me to, while you were getting into that, mm-hmm. I thought I need to get to this PSA. So this is a Social Security related PSA that I wanted to dig up, Chris, mm-hmm. and then we'll get into another Social Security question.
Okay.
But it has to do not with this, it has to do with something else that you asked for. That's why I wanted to dig this up. Because you asked for people to share some more information. Do you remember the question that you answered for somebody who they applied online and they kept getting some confusing information on whether or not the application had been accepted? Do you remember all of that?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, so it kept showing as pending, and they were approaching the date when it should have turned on, and they called and said, and they were being told, oh, just wait, it's just a little slow, just wait. I think I put out the call to find out when it actually started coming to them, if it really did end up delaying their benefits after the month they should have received it.
So this gentleman wrote a very long email. And I apologize that it took me so long. He sent it just about a month ago. But when you were answering this and saying, hey, be giving a call out to people to share their situation, I remembered this email. So here's that situation, folks. So a little bit of a PSA, a little divergence to a PSA. Hi, Jim and Chris. It says, I really enjoy the deep dives and banter. I listen while doing my house chores, cooking, cleaning, and laundry. This is further information for Chris about applying online for Social Security benefits. He has a state question, though, for you, Chris. I didn't realize that. I think you'll get this one. Okay. So the state question. The marathon of this state attracts a national and international field and crosses 5 bridges.
It sounds like the Boston Marathon, but the 5 bridges has me questioning it a little because I don't remember when I visited Boston crossing a lot of bridges. I know there are bridges, but whether the race crosses 5, that part I don't know. Maybe that's a particular hint trying to lead me to Seattle or somewhere. I don't know. I'll stick with Boston, my first answer, though.
Boston. Okay. So simultaneously, as I was speaking, you know I turn on the voice recognition for chat. So chat did guess the correct state, New York City. I thought for sure you would have got it. The marathon you're referring to is New York City Marathon held in New York. My answer is New York. But can Chris crack it? Given the prominence of the New York City Marathon and its unique course, it's well known among sports enthusiasts and the general public alike. Considering Chris's previous performance on this knowledge base, I believe Chris is going to get this question right. Mm-hmm. So my guess, yes, Chris will get this.
So take right. away a point from him because he was wrong.
Well, see, he keeps score. So hold on.
Okay.
Hey, chat, you're wrong. Chris actually got this one wrong. That just didn't sound right. Hey, chat, you're wrong. Chris got this wrong.
See, I think there should be a penalty for him.
I think we broke it.
Okay. Well, we can answer. We can listen to the PSA while it thinks.
No, it kept it 0-0. It says, scoring update. Chat GPT, incorrect prediction. Thought Chris would get it right. 0 points. Chris, incorrect answer, 0 points. Current score, 3-3.
Okay.
So you see how it's keeping score?
I guess. It changes the rules all the time, so.
He does. Okay. I thought for sure you were going to get that one. All right. Anyways, I digress. I will be 70 in August of 2025. So I applied April 14th of 2025, essentially 4 months prior to my start date. Uh-huh. On last week's podcast, you had a question or comment from a listener complaining they didn't get an answer when applying online.
Oh, this and so Chris, this PSA is from someone else, not that original story. But that was the original story, was this?
Correct.
Yeah, okay.
And Chris urged people to apply at the office.
No, I didn't. The listener did. Remember, I said, don't flood the offices with this because they're already backed up. It'd be better still to do online.
Well, that was his next sentence.
Okay.
Chris warned that the recommendation was premature and risked overwhelming the limited office staff.
Yeah.
And Chris asked for other people's experience. So here is my experience to share with him. I will summarize this by saying the communication I received from Social Security is quite confusing and seemingly contradicts itself. But the bottom line is, it does say online within 2 weeks of my online request the following. Your claim has been approved, but will continue to show pending until the month you elected to start your benefits. Mm. He says, for example, I received on April 15th, and he sent me what he received, and he highlighted what he wanted me to read in yellow. And he clearly did receive an email, and in it, it said, I'm not going to read the whole email. You should receive a letter in the mail within 30 days with a decision or to request additional information. If you have a future month of entitlement, you should receive a letter in the mail approximately 30 days before your benefits start. You can check the status of your application online or call us with any questions. Please wait 5 days from the time that you filed before checking your online status. So he said, on April 29th, I decided to check my online status, and this is what I received. He said, it is poorly written, but I do think it says my application for Social Security benefits is approved, but I will not receive further confirmation until 30 days prior to my August 2025, my 70th birthday month, or perhaps not even until the end of September, which is when the check will be sent out. And that's what he said. And he sent me a screenshot of what he received. And this is literally in the screenshot. Your benefit application, it takes 30 days for a decision. This time frame is an estimate for your reference. We started step 2 of 3 in the review process. A representative in Jamaica Plain, New York, started reviewing your application on April 14th. For most people, this review will take 30 days. Your claim has been approved, and that's all in bold he receives. But you will continue to show pending until the month you elect to start your benefits. For example, if you chose August 2021 to start benefits, your claim status will show pending until on or about August 10th of 2021. After this time, your claim status will be updated to show the application process is complete. We will mail you a notice within 10 to 15 days of completing the application process. So that's what it seems to do. It just kind of locks on that until the month you're going to receive benefits. Hmm.
So pending doesn't mean it hasn't been approved. It's not that the application is pending. It's just that the benefit start is still pending, is kind of, which is confusing to people. I agree with this person.
So anyways, just a little bit of info for everybody. So when you apply online, it does clearly say it's not easy to spot, but they do put it in bold. Your claim has been approved, but will continue to show pending until the month you elected to start your benefits. It's the same size font, Chris, and unless you're really looking for it, it's not easy to see. But they did put in bold, has been approved, but the entire sentence doesn't stand out. Unless you noticed it, you wouldn't know that it's been approved, but it will continue forever to say pending, even though it's been approved, and it won't change until the month you begin. That's just bizarre, but that's just what this gentleman wanted to share.
That's helpful. I think that's good. So hopefully that sounds like it is working quite smoothly for him. So I think that's good that not everybody's facing delays everywhere.
Okay. All right. Next Social Security question. Hi, Jim. Greetings to you and Chris. And he does provide a hint. And he says, this is the only state where two U.S. presidents are buried in the same crypt. I know you'll get this, Chris.
I think
it's
this
one. A repeat question.
Yeah, I think I know. And I think I remember visiting the church, actually. I think it's the Adams brothers. And it was when I was visiting Massachusetts and I didn't stray much from there. So I'm pretty sure it was in Massachusetts that I saw that.
You are correct, and ChatGPT was correct, obviously, because it goes on the internet, and it actually included a picture of the crypt. But do I think Chris can crack it? This is a niche piece of presidential trivia. Unless Chris has strong interest in U.S. presidential history or has visited the site, I don't think he'll know this. It's easy to assume presidents are buried individually. So my guess, no, I do not think Chris will get this right.
Well, look at that.
Yes. Let me know how Chris did, and I will update the scoreboard. Hey, chat, Chris did get the question right.
See, and I think he should suffer a penalty for guessing wrong.
Well, it gave you credit. It says, whoa, that's impressive. Presidential burial trivia isn't exactly common water for cooler tank talk.
Had I not visited it, I don't think I would have known it. So it's due to the reasons that he rightly pointed out, or she, well, I guess we're the genderless chat, that I'd been there. That's really the only reason that...
well, that's what it said, unless Chris visited it. So
that was
anyways.
Why. Yeah.
It was updated.
It was not long.
4-3.
It was in the same era where I was very underwhelmed by my visit to Plymouth Rock, which was, as everyone knows,
yes.
They should remove that. It's a tourist trap. It's ridiculous.
Oh, without a doubt, it's a tourist trap. But it got you to go there, and I bet you bought lunch or something in Plymouth.
I don't recall that, but probably.
Okay. See, it worked. You went to go see a stupid rock in the ocean.
Yeah. So they should call it the Plymouth Pebble.
All right, here's the question. If memory serves me, Chris has already talked about this issue, but it was quite a long time ago. I think there's a special rule regarding full retirement age or your 70th birthday if your birthday is the first day of the month, because I was born on September 1st. How and when should I apply for Social Security if I want my benefits to begin at age 70 because I was born on the first of the month? Thanks again for the podcast. I really enjoy it and have learned so much from you too, the rest of your team and your guests. Well, thank you very much, listener. I know you talked about the first of the month thing in the past, Chris. I honestly can't remember what it was, but anything that this person has to do because they were born September 1st?
No, I know what they're talking about. When you're born on the first of the month, it does affect your first month of eligibility for Social Security. That's when you turn 62. And what I mean by that is your first month of eligibility is technically the month in which you are 62 the entire month. So if you're born on the 15th, you turn 62 on the 15th, you might think, oh, that's the first month you can start benefits, when in fact, it's the next month. You're not 62 all month long until the following month. Well, they have a special rule for those of us, I'm included, because I was born on April 1st, that if you were born on the 1st, for purposes of this rule, you are considered to have been born the month before, and in the same month, me in April and this listener in September, are considered to be 62 the entire month in the same month I turn 62, which is on the 1st. So I essentially have an earlier, not me personally, but everyone born on the 1st of the month has a first month of eligibility a month earlier than everybody else on every other day of the month with a birthday. That's the only place that it really affects you. For purposes of full retirement age, delayed retirement credits, when you turn age 70, that is the month. It's because those aren't based on you being that age, a particular age for the entire month. It's those triggers are the month in which you turn that certain age, which is true for her in September. She's going to turn 70. So she would want to start her benefits in September of the year she turns 70 if she wants to have it turned on immediately when her Social Security is at its maximum amount. So that's where there's that really weird rule for people born on the first. It really only matters to people who are turning on their benefit at 62 or prior to your full retirement age, because there's a slight change in the calculation for early claiming because of the number of months they count. But it's tiny because it's only a shift of 1 month. So it's not an effect that most people notice. But one thing they would notice is, in what month can, if I'm trying to claim as early as possible, if you're born on the first, you actually get to claim a month earlier than anybody else born that same month. So there's the little benefit to being born on the first.
Perfect. I knew there was something that had to do with it.
Yeah.
Okay. Now we're going to jump into regular questions, folks. And Chris, what next to Social Security, which is very confusing for people, what is the next topic, do you think, that seems to generate a lot of confusion and consternation for our listeners?
Can we not have a show where we have a reprieve from the 5-year rule? That's got to be what you're talking about.
We got several 5-year rule questions again. Okay. I don't know how this causes so much confusion.
Well, maybe they sent these in before our most recent
this one came in 3 days ago.
Oh, okay.
This is the new question of the week.
Okay.
And they begin by apologizing for sending another 5-year rule question. Hi, Jim and Chris. So sorry to belabor this subject. I know you're tired of it. But I have to ask this because I need to clarify something. I thought I was clear on it, but then I got contradictory information from a financial advisor with one of the organizations at which I have retirement accounts from previous employment. So in other words, folks, she has a old, I'm guessing, work retirement account. Not sure if it's a 401k, a TSB, 457, 403b, whatever it is. She has a previous employer, an account still at the previous employer, and she spoke to an advisor, most likely an advisor to the plan. Okay. What's my situation? I have a traditional IRA with that company. He doesn't name it. If she did, we wouldn't name it. But I also have Roth IRAs with other companies. And those Roths are decades old. I personally am well over 59 and a half. This is a woman. She doesn't say how old, but well over. I'm guessing somewhere in her 60s or 70s, perhaps. Maybe even older. I am well over 59 and a half. If I convert this traditional IRA, remember, folks, at her previous employer, the IRA is not with the previous employer. Let me clarify that. She has an account with the custodian of her previous employer's 401k. She has an IRA account with that custodian. Right. If I convert that traditional IRA to a Roth, will I have to wait 5 years to access my growth tax-free within the Roth? In other words, will the 5-year rule apply separately to each of my conversions, even though I have a pre-existing seasoned Roth IRA, to borrow Chris's term, meaning it's over 5 years old? That's Chris's verbiage. He calls it seasoned. And remember, I am over 59 and a half. The financial advisor told me each conversion will be different, and I will have a 5-year clock for each conversion. I don't think that's true, but who is correct, me or them? Thank you.
Well, I have good news for her. We can answer it very quickly. You are in a position where at no point for the rest of your life should you ever concern yourself with a 5-year rule for Roths. Neither rule affects you for the rest of your life. Others you know, friends and family, you might want to know to pass on the information to them, but for you, there is no five-year rule implications for the rest of your life. This advisor didn't understand how either your circumstance fit into the five-year rule or how the five-year rule works, because you are well past any need to worry about the five-year rule, either of the five-year rules.
What this advisor told her is the same mistake, if you remember. Mm-hmm.
That's her name. Susie Orman.
Do not.
Oh, sorry.
Susie Orman. I did not want you to talk. I can never remember her name.
I heard you whisper, what's her name? So I thought you were asking.
I was whispering to myself, not to you. This is the same mistake Susie Orman made last year in one of her articles. I don't think she actually physically wrote it. Probably one of her minions did. People just, they know that there's a separate five-year rule on conversions, and they think that continues forever. They don't understand the rule. The five-year rule on conversion goes away once you reach 59 and a half.
Right.
This woman is, quote-unquote, well over. Also, the mere fact that she has had Roth IRAs for decades means she has satisfied the other five-year rule, which is your Roth needs to be 5 years old and you are dead, disabled, buying a first-time home or over the age of 59 and a half. She satisfied all of those.
Correct.
She's over 59 and a half. She has a Roth that's more than 5 years old. As Chris said, no more five-year rules apply to her at all.
Right.
Her advisor, I don't think she's... I don't think this advisor is her personal advisor. It was whoever she was talking to about converting this IRA into a Roth IRA. Just doesn't quite understand the rules. It's just no other way of putting it.
Right.
But anyways, that was five-year rule question one.
Wait a minute.
Are we?
Question, we got more of those coming up?
Unfortunately.
Oh, Jim,
okay.
You're killing me.
This one, though, came in well over a year ago, so I apologize for not finding it sooner. Hi, Jim and Chris. I have enjoyed the comical number of five-year rule questions you have had recently. And Q&A show 2427 left me with another. This has been going on. This is how long this for years, years and years and years, Chris and I still get five-year questions. So this came in last August. Okay. Oh, you're not going to get this state question.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way. This state is home to the butter cow.
Can you define butter cow?
No.
Oh,
wait a minute.
Well, I can.
It's a cow made out of butter.
Well, I can certainly hazard a guess.
Okay.
I'd say it's in one of the two states most known for dairy production, which in my brain is Wisconsin or California. Both produce a tremendous amount of dairy. Making a cow out of butter sounds like something they do in Wisconsin. So I'm going to go with Wisconsin.
Iowa.
Oh, I know they have cows in Iowa too, but so I want to acknowledge that.
Iowa is home to the iconic butter cow, viewed at the Iowa State Fair in Des Moines.
That's too bad.
The tradition began in 1911 when J.K. Daniels sculpted the first butter cow, and it has become a beloved symbol of the fair.
Hopefully it's not the same butter.
Each year, the butter cow is displayed alongside a companion of other butter sculptures that celebrate various cultural icons and events. It's a hell of a lot of butter. They got a picture of the butter cow. Anyways, will Chris crack it, according to ChatGPT? Given that the butter cow's prominence in the Iowa State Fair is well-known, especially among those familiar with Midwest traditions. However, other states like Ohio also feature a butter sculpture at their fair, so it's possible Chris will be confused. But my guess, yes, Chris will get this one right.
Well, so we were both wrong again. At least we're marching together.
Hey, chat. Chris did not get this question correct. Okay, so no change in the score. You guys each got 0-0 score. You still win 4-3. Oh, it's still in the lead, 4-3. Okay, now for my question. On the show, and this is again from almost a year ago, folks. On the show, you talked about how the five-year rule for the Roth IRA being established and transferred to a spouse, not a non-spouse, but a spouse. Does that mean that even if the five-year rule had been met by the decedent, the beneficiary still needs to meet their own five-year rule? Or is it only if the deceased passed without having a Roth? The thing that I'm wondering is, could there be a scenario under ALR, at least as rapidly, where the beneficiary doesn't have a Roth yet? And then he gets into Roth 401ks. Since Roth 401ks require RMDs, they no longer do, listener. There are no RMDs from Roth 401ks. So I'm not going to go down that rabbit hole. I'm sorry for yet another five-year rule. I think what he's wondering, because he specified going to a spouse. When a spouse inherits a Roth, they can treat it as their own. They can move it to their own, and they get special treatment. They can use the five-year rule that favors them.
Right.
If the deceased husband or wife, whoever passed away first, had a Roth that was well over 5 years old, and they didn't, they get to use the decedent's. If the decedent, like the question that started this from a couple weeks ago, the gentleman who did a deathbed conversion and died 2 days after doing a conversion, if the deceased spouse had only a two-day-old Roth, but the beneficiary spouse had a 20-year-old Roth, they can use theirs. The spouse gets to choose the better of the two. Non-spouse beneficiary does not have that capability. So see, that's not too bad of an answer, Chris.
No, that wasn't too bad.
No. Okay. You ready for the next question?
I'm ready.
All right, how many have we done? That's number five, right?
That's four plus
counting the PSA.
Four plus a PSA.
Okay, let's see if we can get a couple more done. I have a few more opened. Let me see. This is a good one. This is in reference to a show we just did recently. Says, hey guys, love the show. Well, this is a repeat. There's no doubt in my mind you'll get this one correct. If you don't get this one correct, you should hang it up. This state is where Field of Dreams was filmed.
First of all, I don't like when you put all that pressure on me, telling me that I'm a failure as a human if I can't get this one correct. But
I didn't mean it that way. I feel you're going to get this one correct.
Yeah. Well, now you have me second guessing myself. I think it's Indiana, but it could be Iowa. So I'm going to go with Indiana.
No!
Iowa?
Iowa.
Yeah. So,
so close.
You got me
so
all freaked
close.
Out by saying I'm a failure of humanity if I can't get this correct.
Can Chris crack it? Given the film's enduring popularity and the fact that Field of Dreams is a well-known landmark in Iowa, Chris should know this. My guess, yes, Chris will get this one right.
Well, at least I'm still ahead 4-3.
Hey, chat, you are correct. No. Whoops, hold on. Both of you are wrong.
Right.
Hey, chat. Chris got this one wrong.
So we're
holding
steady at 4-3.
It is still holding steady, 4-3.
Yeah, chat doesn't need free points. Don't give him any free points.
All right. This is in regards to the couple who was wondering if they had too much money in their health savings account. Mm-hmm. Okay. They made really good points on needing to pull the money out within 1 year of death. We don't have nearly as much money as they do, but we do follow the same philosophy of saving all our receipts and keeping them available. The one thing I don't think you really touched on, though, was the fact that one of the people couldn't qualify for long-term care insurance because they had lupus. If you remember that original question, I think they had, was it 500,000 in HSAs or three? I can't remember.
Might have been 350. It was a lot.
Okay, they had quite a bit of money in an HSA account, and yes, one of them had lupus. I, too, am disqualified from receiving long-term care insurance, and having a heavily funded HSA is part of my long-term care strategy, since it is likely I will need some type of LTC coverage when I get older. And it's only going to keep getting more expensive. I agree this is not as good as actual long-term care insurance. But remember, they're disqualified from getting LTC insurance, listeners. It is a tax advantage vehicle, though, for helping me to self-fund my long-term care needs down the road. If you figure about $120,000 a year for long-term care coverage, then a $300,000 HSA is not going to last long, probably less than 3 years. So he is right, listeners, and Chris in general, you can add your thoughts, that money inside an HSA can be used to pay for your long-term care needs because it can be withdrawn tax-advantaged. I would say, though, so can money in an IRA. At least under current laws, where we have the 10%, it has to exceed, is it 7.5 or 10? I always forget.
7.5.
How? 7.5. So your any health expenses that exceed 7.5% of your, is it AGI or gross income?
AGI.
AGI. So any healthcare expenses that exceed 7.5% of your adjusted gross income will be deductible for you, meaning you could take those dollars out of a traditional IRA and be able to deduct them on your taxes, allowing you to get essentially tax-free withdrawals from your IRA as well. And this gentleman is correct. I'm guessing he has or will have about $300,000, and he's thinking it's going to buy him a couple of years of LTC coverage. Perhaps his HSA in conjunction with his IRA will give him some tax advantage, if not tax-free withdrawals, allowing his dollars to go a little bit deeper, rather than having to give the feds 15, 20, 25, 30%, who knows what taxes will be in the future when this gentleman needs LTC help. At least he'll be able to have the dollars that would have went to the government instead be going to his care. So he is correct that HSA is not, you don't get the leverage of a long-term care policy by any stretch with an HSA. He did get a deduction of those dollars going in, which he might not have received with, well, he should have actually received it with his IRA. I apologize there. So he would have got that tax deduction as well. The ability to build up, though, between now and when he's going to need long-term care coverage, any receipt that he has for out-of-pocket expenses that he paid, and it's quite a long list of what's deductible in HSAs, to save all those receipts and $20 here, $50 here, $500 there, $2,000 there, all begins to add up. There could be other distributions he can do in the future tax-free from his HSA. Mm-hmm. So anyways, he just kind of wanted to share that, Chris, that he cannot get LTC coverage, but he's viewing his HSA as a reserve for long-term care protection.
Yeah. Well, they make sense, especially when you have a known health issue without insurance backing it. So I think your HSA could be quite large and not be worried about it being too big, especially if you're using the technique of accumulating receipts where a large chunk of it could be used. Just make sure you leave instructions for your kids. So if they end up inheriting by accident, you know, it didn't go as planned as far as life expectancy, and you've got a big HSA, and that they know to use all those receipts to drain that HSA as much as possible in the year of death, claiming those expenses. Good letter of instruction for them, and teach them how to do that and show them where the receipts are would be a good idea.
Yeah, that is a very good point. If you might know where they are, but if you can't communicate that, it doesn't do your beneficiaries any good. All right, I think that was all I had pulled, but let me make sure. There's the inherited.
I thought you said you had one more.
I thought so. Let me see. Yes, okay. Okay, this one's a very short question, Chris. No state hint. And I think I know what they're asking, but I'm not 100% certain. So if I don't quite answer this question correctly, listener, just fire off another email to me and add a little bit more clarity. This came in 2 months ago. I just listened to your podcast episode on this. This, I'm guessing, folks, is tips. My question is, can you lose the principal upon maturity of a bond ETF if yields significantly increase? For example, let's say yields today are 4%, but what if they rise to 7%? Will I lose principal in my bond ETF? I tried to follow the calculation on, and she names the ETF she's going to buy. We won't name the custodian, but very famous one. I tried to follow the calculation on the custodian's website, or sponsor, not really custodian, the sponsor of the ETF. But I'm not really sure about the answer it gave me, and she didn't tell me what the answer was. This kind of ties into the EDU show we just did a couple of days ago, folks. Mm-hmm. When interest rates go up, the price of bonds goes down.
Right.
When interest rates go down, the price of bonds goes up. Just think of it rationally for those who don't quite understand this. And if you remember on the EDU show, both Jake and I had listened to Andy Panko's Q&A show from a week or two ago, and somebody lost money in the BND fund, which Chris looked up was a Vanguard bond fund, correct,
yeah,
Chris?
It's a Vanguard total bond index fund or something along those lines.
So why do principal? So you can lose principal, listener, in a ETF or a mutual fund that invests in bonds. You can lose principal. If interest rates go up, price of bonds goes down. Why? Let's say Chris has a bond paying him 4%. But new bonds, a fancy-dancy new bond, is paying 6%. Now, Chris needs the money for one reason or another. So he goes out to try to sell his bond. He would do that by going to his brokerage custodian and listing the bond for sale. He's going to sell his bond. If somebody is buying bonds, are they going to want Chris's used bond paying 4% or some fancy-dancy new one paying 6%? Not too many people are going to want Chris's bond, right, when they can get a brand new one paying more. What happens, Chris, to the price of something nobody wants?
Well, the price of my bond that I was offering would drop because there was no demand for it. And it would drop until the benefit of the lower price that someone was paying offsets the lower interest payments that are promised on that bond. So there is a point at which my bond, there is a price at which my bond becomes competitive, but not at what we might call full price. So yes, the value of my bond would decline when nobody wants it because I have a less than attractive interest payment promise on the bond I own.
Now, let's say Chris's bond was paying 6%. New bonds are paying 4. Chris needs the money, so he goes to sell his bond. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, there's people out there in the bond world, and they're like, gosh, God, 4%, 4%, 4%. Oh, wow, look at this one, 6. I think a lot of people are going to want Chris's bond because it's paying substantially more. Mm-hmm. Chris, what happens to the price of something that everybody wants, but there's not too much of them?
Well, if everybody wants it, there's a lot of demand, and the price of my bond would go up until the price gets high enough to offset the bonus, the attractive interest that my bond is paying compared to those new bonds. And so the price does have an upper limit, but it would rise if I had that kind of a situation where my current bond I owned was paying a higher interest payment than new bonds that were being issued by, you know, similar companies.
Now, she doesn't say much more than that. She just gave her name.
One thing I do want to point out, which is going to tie into kind of where I'm sure your answer is going, is that the one thing that is true, even though over the life of the bond, as interest rates go down, the price of the bond goes up and vice versa, something different happens when the bond reaches maturity, because at maturity, the bond will pay a contractually based payment called the par value or the face value, and regardless of what interest rates are on that day. So as the bond approaches maturity, and on the day of maturity in particular, it has a price or value that is unaffected by interest rates. It is, in fact, what the par value is. So you have that if you own an individual bond. But as you know, Jim, things are a bit different in a bond fund.
Correct. She did put in the subject line, though, target outcome ETFs. But she never mentioned that in her question. Mm. So if you're talking about a bond fund, listener, that contains a bond ladder, and that bond ladder is designed where all the bonds in that ladder will mature in the same year, that is how I interpret targeted outcome. That is going to trade more like you going out and buying a bond yourself. As long as you hold it till maturity, what happens in between is just noise. It will mature at par. Now, a lot is going to depend in this targeted outcome ETF. If any of the bonds, or how many of the bonds, if some are, trading at a premium or a discount that the bond ETF is holding, if the bond ETF paid a premium or a discount. Everything matures at par. Let's say par is an even $1,000. Sometimes bond managers will overpay for a bond and they pay a premium, they call it. As Chris said, price bonds go up as interest rates go down, but it'll rise to a certain level where it would be worth paying a little bit more for the added interest. And at maturity, you get less because you paid a premium. You willfully paid more than the bond is going to mature for. However, the extra interest rate you're going to earn between current market rates and what that bond is paying, that extra interest will make up for what you're not going to get back when the bond matures. So it gets very, very confusing. Stocks are easy, and I think even Andy said this in his question to his listener. Stock trading is relatively easy. Bonds opens up a whole can of worms. Premium bonds, discount bonds, callable bonds. It goes on and on and on. So with these targeted ETFs, what I would suggest you do is you can look at their websites, and many will allow you to dig deep into their holdings and show you what. I wish Jacob was on this show, because for the one that, and I don't want to name who we use when we use these products, but that particular custodian, when we go to their website, they give us a yield, but they don't call it the yield to maturity. They call it something else because it factors in a couple of the non-traditional factors, if you will, in a yield to maturity calculation. In fact, they go to great lengths on the website to say, hey, this is not yield to maturity in the traditional sense, but it is the yield you can expect to receive based on the interest payments of all the bonds that we currently hold, our management fee compounded over the remaining maturity period of this ETF, whether you're buying one that matures in 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, they go all the way out to 10 years. So this, gosh, if Jacob knows the name of this yield to something, and we'll get Jacob back on the show because he deals with this all the time with the custodian and he gets this number for us. But it's similar to yield to maturity, listener. So if you're considering one of these, go to their website. You will be able to see a couple of things. How many premium bonds are in there? How many discount bonds are in there? How many bonds did they buy at par? And this magical number that is very similar to yield to maturity, which will reflect the management fee of the ETF, which is not in a normal yield to maturity calculation. It will also reflect premium bonds because they know they're not going to get all of the principal back, and discount bonds that they may own where they're going to get more back than what they paid. So they roll all of this in and they give you a yield. And if you buy that ETF, you can expect to receive your money back with that additional yield. Now, between the day you buy a defined maturity ETF and the day it matures, which could be up to 10 years in the future, your ETF is going to go up and down in value. That's just being reflective of the price of bonds as they change. But what makes these defined outcome ETFs unique is that the value of those bonds, or the maturity of the bonds, rather, in the ETF will all mature in the year that the ETF is set to just go away. It just pays out. The one we use pays out on October 15th. So if you bought the one that matures in 2032, I'm just making that up, and it's 2025 as we do this, so 7 years from now. On October 15th, 7 years from now, that ETF ceases to exist. All money is paid out. The way this manager does it is all bonds right up to the year of maturity. So this would be 2032. All bonds that are or dollars that are coming in and interest that's coming in, if it's not being reinvested or withdrawn, rather, the ETF provider will continue to buy bonds that mature in 2032 and prior to October 15th of 2032. In the year it matures, 2032, it will stop buying bonds. So there'll be no more purchasing of bonds. They will hold those dollars in cash. And it's designed that in 2032, everything pays out. So theoretically speaking, you should receive your money back plus whatever that yield number is. It's not called yield to maturity because, again, it will factor in the fees that you're paying in the ETF, which generally are 10 bips or less. But you're going to be factoring in the fees of the ETF compounded over the remaining number of years, as well as the number of premium bonds and discount bonds. And they come fairly close to letting you see about what you'll receive back. And if you reinvest that yield into it, it's also including that. It's not including you taking the money out. Typical to yield to maturity, you're reinvesting. So I don't know if that is what your question was on, But the subject mentioned, that the subject line of the email said targeted outcome ETF, but your body made it sound more like, hey, if I bought a exchange traded fund that invested in bonds and interest rates go up, will I lose money? Yes. But if it's a defined maturity ETF designed to pay out at a certain date in the future, I say theoretically you should get all of your money back, unless they pay every single bond in there is a premium bond and you're buying in when everything is at a premium. I highly doubt that. And even if it's a premium bond, there's nothing wrong with that. It's just that, hey, you're not going to get all of your principal back, but if you reinvest the interest, remember these interest payments you're getting, the interest payments are priced in a way where the added interest will make up for the fact that your bond is going to mature for less than you put in. That's why you paid a premium for it. It's got higher interest rates than current market rates. Now, that's not your question, but I'm just trying to guess what you're saying. We personally feel rather comfortable putting client money in these, but we also reinvest all dollars back in, and we do take a look at how much or how many premium bonds and discount bonds are in there, and how many bonds did they buy at par. I don't want to even begin to hazard a guess, because I haven't looked in many, many months. Jacob, that's why if he was on the show, he would know more. But to the best of my memory, when I did look at a few of these issues, the number of premium bonds was not excessive. I believe it was under 17% or even significantly under that on one in particular we were looking at. But in and of itself, premium bonds don't offend us at all. Premium bonds, when adjusted for the extra interest, you may not get all your principal back, technically speaking, but all that extra interest netting out current interest rates will make up. I hope I'm explaining that right, Chris. I know you don't do this, so did you follow some of what I'm trying to say, or are you lost?
Oh, no. I can follow it. I think that made sense for people. And if you're reinvesting those interest payments, if that's part of the way the fund is built, then it doesn't matter if they're a premium or not. The interest payments will offset that.
Correct.
By the target date when the thing kind of everything wraps up, when everything matures.
Now, if you believe in the official market theory, all of this is priced in. Can a good active manager find sometimes an anomaly and try to play the arbitrage between what a premium bond and the interest payments or a discount bond? Yes. But these particular ETFs are not structured to do that. That would be more of an active ETF. Yeah. These targeted outcome ETFs, to me, are designed to buy, to hold, to reinvest your money. You should get all of your money back, plus not the yield to maturity, because it's not called that, but the yield to whatever that is. And Jacob, I'll bring him on the show shortly to answer that. That's the number you want. That is the true yield to maturity in quotation marks, because the ETF provider, or at least the one we use, and I would assume they're all going to do this, they're going to say, hey, we'll factor this in for you. We know what we hold. We know what's trading at a premium. We know what's at a discount. We know our management fee. We're going to give you the equivalent of a yield to maturity, but it's not the true yield to maturity calculation, because in a yield to maturity calculation, you're not factoring in fees of an ETF.
Yeah. On that, I want to wrap up really quick before I lose the podcast recording, because the lightning is back and it's super close. So thanks, everybody, for listening. If you want to send in a question to Jim, send it to jim@jimhelps.com. That's jim@jimhelps.com. Put in the subject line it's a question for the podcast and a word or two about the topic. We are moving into Annuity Awareness Month, so annuity questions will get top priority, at least for the next 30 days. Jim, I hope some of this rain hits you, because it's raining here again. But mostly
no rain here. In fact, it's only partly cloudy here.
Yeah, the electrical activity is making me a little nervous. Got a little flickering here, and if we're in the middle of the recording when it hits my house, we're gonna lose it. So we're gonna take off. Everybody stay safe, stay out of the lightning, and we'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.